AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
Life in our modern age comes at you pretty fast, which makes our time away especially valuable. When I take time to relax, I like to get far from my everyday life, immerse myself in natural beauty, and have unique experiences. But you don't have to leave the U.S. to experience tropical rainforests and islands filled with adventure, warm culture, and national treasures. Visit Puerto Rico, an island with a vibrant spirit that will sweep you away. Because when you visit, you don't become part of the island, it becomes part of you. In Puerto Rico, you can forget where you came from and embrace where you are. Puerto Rico, where visits end, but stories last forever. No passport required for U.S. citizens and permanent residents. Learn more and plan your trip at discoverpuertorico.com.
Hello, Maine and Greater New England.
Hello.
We're coming to see you guys in Portland, and we can't wait. We would love to see you there.
Yep, we'll be at the State Theater on August 30th, and if you're interested, you can get tickets and information at sysklive.com.
Throw some lobster at us.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. There's Charles W. Chuck Bryant. There's Jerry over there. And wowie zowie.
Pavement's best record?
I think, no, hold on. No, it's not wowie zowie. It's not Crooked Rain, Crooked Rain.
What's the one between them?
With Summer Babe.
Oh, no, that was the first one. That's Slanted and Enchanted.
Okay, that was their first album?
Mm-hmm.
God, what a classic, man.
Yeah.
I think that's their best one, is it not?
Well, Crooked Rain gets cited a lot of times as sort of the peak Pavement.
Mm-hmm.
Slanted is for fans of like the early Sloppy Days, lo-fi, which we both love.
Sure.
I like Wowie Zowie because it was so strange and weird.
I haven't heard that one very much.
It's great.
Okay.
They're all great. I like them even right down to the last one.
That's good. The weird polka experimental album that they came out with?
They're playing, they announced they're playing another couple of reunion shows at a festival in Portugal.
Wow.
And we're in touch with Mr. Bob Nastanovich, mm-hmm. and I texted him.
Yeah.
And it's like, do I have to go to Portugal? Is anything brewing here in the States?
Uh-huh.
It's like, because I'll go.
What did he say?
He said, nothing as of yet. He's like, so go with God.
Are you going to go to Portugal?
Maybe. If that's the only chance to see Pavement again,
yeah,
I might.
Yeah, sure.
Because I want to go to Portugal
anyway.
You
have frequent flyer miles to use?
A ton.
Do it. You totally should. And drink some port while you're there, too.
Yeah, you know, my friend's opening up a wine shop in Kirkwood that is very, not exclusively Portuguese, but that's where she's from.
Oh, cool.
It's going to be featuring a lot of Portuguese wines.
That works really well with this episode, Chuck.
Great.
As we'll see later on. But just put a pin in Portuguese wine.
Okay.
And for later.
All right. So you started off by saying the words wowie zowie.
Because we're talking about peyote, which is an hallucinogen.
That's right.
But it's from what I've seen, one of the oldest hallucinogens. People were eating mushrooms all over Europe, North, Central, Western Europe for a very long time.
Sometimes accidentally, which is hysterical.
But people have been eating peyote for a really, really long time, too, as we'll see.
Yeah.
Thousands and thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, it's got a pretty interesting little history to it, both ancient and modern.
Yeah.
And really, all it comes down to is it's a spineless cactus that has a very bitter taste.
Hey, that's not nice.
That never stands up for itself. But it is a spineless cactus, uh-huh. which means, well, if it's a spineless cactus, that means that desert animals probably love to eat it. They don't, because it has a really bitter taste, and that bitter taste is an alkaloid called mescaline.
Right, and that it's a sign, it's nature's sign saying, don't eat me.
Right, but just so happens that if we humans eat that particular alkaloid, we say things like, wowie zowie.
That's right.
Right.
So, yeah, let's go. It is native to Mexico in the southern U.S. It is technically, the scientific name is Lophophora Williamsii. Now, we decided that two I's means you pronounce both, right?
You have to go E-E.
And it grows in northern Mexico and south Texas, right along the border there.
Sure. Peyote knows no borders.
That's true. And it loves the rocky limestone. And in historical documents, it's had a range all the way up to New Mexico, perhaps.
Yeah.
And we've either changed that with human interaction or that was just wrong.
Right. But it definitely grows along the border.
Yeah, and it looks like a little... growing up, did you ever see those little tomato pincushions?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Looks sort of like that, but it's not red.
Yeah, I guess. And it doesn't have pins sticking out of it.
No. Although you could stick a pin in it.
Sure you could.
Put a bird on it.
It'd be very disrespectful to the spirit within the peyote, though.
That's right.
It probably wouldn't like that very much.
That's true. Like a little peyote voodoo doll.
Sure. So like we said, the mescaline is to tell animals, stay away, don't eat me. They also think it's possible that it has something to do with communications between plants. It may do a number of different things, actually. But one of the things about peyote is it has this reputation, a very mystical reputation, not just because it's a psychedelic and an hallucinogen, mm-hmm. but because it is really, really hard to find until it's not. It's got this reputation where you'll be looking all over for peyote. Mm-hmm. It grows in the rocky soil, and typically it'll grow under like a creosote bush or a mesquite tree or something like that.
Yeah, nurse plant.
Right. But
which
you
I
can
love
have
that term.
Looked. You can have looked all over underneath the creosote tree or whatever, and you walk away, and then you're like, I'll just go back and look again. And there it is, just staring you right in the face.
You trip over a rock and you land on it.
Right. There's the peyote. So it's got this kind of neat little... reputation for hiding, it playing hide and go seek with you, and then it's like, okay, all right, go ahead and eat me and trip. I was going to say something else.
Like I said, it's not red. They can be brighter green, but they can also look sort of bluish.
Yeah,
which is interesting.
That nice like steel blue green.
Yeah,
it's a pretty color.
It is, and they grow usually in clusters with multiple plants. But sometimes you can find them individually, and I think they're very pretty. They have little pink, white, and yellow flowers. Mm-hmm. They grow very low to the ground, and they're just, it looks like, you know.
Stubby.
A little stubby tomatillo with.
Pincushion.
Yeah, but it's not completely round. It has, like, sections.
It's almost cylindrical a little bit, too.
Yeah.
So, I see what you mean.
You know what I mean?
I know.
We're on peyote right now, everyone.
A little bit.
Sorry. That's not true.
Oh. This plant in particular has a weird history of getting confused with other plants because some of the other plants that go around it are also consumed by some of the indigenous tribes in the area and have been. But there's like a type of peyote plant that it's not psychedelic. It just makes you kind of sleepy.
Sure.
There's something called a plant that has mezcal beans that are intoxicants of their own type, but they can also kind of kill you. There was a while there where peyote was called both Lophophora Williamsii and Anhelonium lewinii. Right? Mm-hmm. Both have two eyes on the end. Mm-hmm. And then somebody's like, no, it's the same plant. So there's a lot of confusing horticultural history associated with...
I wonder why.
...with peyote.
Am I right?
It was playing tricks is what it was.
So there is a... people have used it not only for religious purposes, although that's a large part of it, which we'll get to in depth. Mm-hmm. But it does have some antimicrobial properties. I've seen that in really low doses that certain tribes have used it for indigestion, to treat wounds, to give them energy.
To work on a computer for days on end.
Cure hangovers. And like anything psychedelic, you could technically you can use it to help treat mental illness.
Right.
But they don't study that stuff in the United States. So, again, it's always very hard to think about any sort of ecstasy or magic mushrooms or anything. Without studying, like clinical studies.
Well, they did study it for a while. Mescaline, which they isolated it from peyote, was used like LSD was in the 50s until LSD came along.
Right.
And they used it because they thought that maybe you could glean information about the root cause of schizophrenia mm-hmm. by giving mescaline to people with schizophrenia. But they found out it was too unreliable. People's right. experiences were too different.
Yeah.
And there was no kind of structure that the individual followed. And plus, they found out people with schizophrenia could tell the difference between their delusions and delusions brought on by mescaline, which is pretty interesting.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And when was that? In the 50s, I guess?
Pre-50s, because LSD came along in the 50s, so okay. 30s, 40s.
Wow.
Yeah.
So when you harvest peyote, you cut off that stem really close to the ground, and they're known as buttons. They look like, I guess I've described them as pincushions, but they look like little buttons.
It makes sense to call them buttons.
Yeah, and Ed wrote this article, The Grabster. He said a typical trip is 4 to 6 buttons, and I thought that seemed like a lot of peyote because I'd seen photos of some buttons that were like as large as the palm of your hand, and I'm trying to imagine eating 8 things that big, 8 tomatoes that large. That's mm-hmm. a lot of tomatoes. Mm-hmm. But then I looked at other pictures, and I guess those were like just super big
sure.
peyote buttons. And most of them were a couple of inches in circumference. You
were
know?
They that big? I thought they were more like the size of a quarter or something like that.
I think between a quarter and like a silver dollar maybe.
Or a shilling for our friends in the UK.
Is that a pence? Is that a quid? How does that all work?
I don't know. A shilling, oh man, we're going to get emails about this.
Oh, well, that's okay.
A shilling is like 20 pence, I think.
Are you going on record?
Yes.
Okay. But 4 to 6 buttons, that, like you said, it's really bitter, so a lot of times people won't want to eat it. There are all different kinds of ways you can make the tea with it, and we're not giving you a how-to.
Right.
But
it's as simple as that.
This is how people take peyote. Sometimes they'll grind it into a powder and snort it or yeah. put it into a pill.
I saw that you can smoke it, too, when it's dried and powdered.
Oh, yeah?
I've never heard of that before, but I ran across it.
But here's the thing. If you're down south of the border and you're out hunting for peyote, and if this is something you want to do, more power to you, but mm-hmm. be respectful of the plant. Don't go digging it out with a shovel by the roots because you're right. going to kill the plant.
Yeah, that's extremely disrespectful to a peyote plant, especially in the tradition of like groups, indigenous tribes that take peyote for yeah. ritual purposes. You do not kill the plant. You don't cut off the peyote button so low that the roots can't regenerate.
Right.
And you don't dig the plant out. Yet despite that, people do it all the time.
Sure.
And then that combined with feral pigs who like to eat it and trip.
Do they really trip?
I don't know. They definitely like to eat peyote, so okay. probably. Those two combined have really kind of put a hurtin' on peyote mm-hmm. And its range. So people who are like conscious of this stuff say, well, you can also get mescaline out of what's called the San Pedro cactus, which grows up in the Andes, and that's not threatened or vulnerable in any
way. Go get it there.
Yeah, just go down to Peru. Don't stop in Mexico. Keep going south.
Should we take a break?
Let's take a break, Charles.
All right, let's take a break, and we're going to talk a little bit about that mescaline right after this.
Stuff you should know. Josh and Chuck. Stuff you should know.
All right, game off. Let's pause here to talk more about Monopoly Go. Because in Monopoly Go, you can team up with your friends for timed tournaments where you work together to build up each other's boards. It's very nice.
That's right. And the more you win together, the more awesome prizes you unlock. And there's so much to get. I'm talking about unique stickers that you can trade with friends to complete albums for big prizes, cool new playing pieces to travel the boards with, or hilarious emojis for taunting friends when you smash their buildings or heist their vaults.
Plus, Monopoly Go feels new and exciting every day with constantly changing tournaments and challenges, like digging for treasure or a robot pachinko machine. And there's always new timed events that help you win big, like massive multipliers for everything you win or rent frenzies.
That's right. There's always something fun to discover in Monopoly Go. So get off the bench and go download it now for free on Google Play or the App Store. Game on.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI and revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Mescaline.
Go.
That is the primary psychedelic chemical, and that was synthesized, what did you say, 1918 or 19?
1919 by Ernest Spath.
Ernst?
Ernst.
Spith.
That's how you'd say it, the A with an umlaut?
Yeah.
So you go, pff.
Ernst Spith.
Ernst.
An Austrian chemist.
Sorry, Ernst. I do like your name.
Who I did a little research. This is kind of the thing he did.
That's big enough, don't you think?
Sure.
The guy isolated mescaline for Pete's sake.
Oh, no. I'm not knocking it. I was just, I thought it was going to be like, and you know what else he did?
Right.
And this is kind of what he did. He's known for that.
Right. Like, Joseph Priestley, who was like, I discovered nitrous oxide, and I also discovered 10 other things.
And start on Beverly Hills 90210.
Yeah. Have you ever seen my shirt? It's the Judas Priest logo, but it says Jason Priestley.
I have not.
It's pretty great.
Is his face anywhere in it, or nope. Is it just a...
It just looks like the Judas Priest logo, but it says Jason Priestley.
Nice. I got to see those. I like some of those shirts.
It's one of the good ones.
The one I used to hate was the... When Farfugnugan was the big thing and the hippies would wear
don't say it.
Effing Groovin'.
Yeah.
I hated those.
Me too.
Oy. All right.
So, Spith?
Spith.
Isolated mescaline in 1919. The following year, the pharmaceutical company Merck is like, oh, we'll just turn this into a pharmaceutical.
Of course they did.
Started to get studied and released and things were going along fairly swimmingly for it. It's a phenylethylamine, which makes it different, actually, from LSD and psilocybin, which are tryptophans. They're in the indole family. Phenylethylamine is the family that mescaline is in and MDMA is in. And it's no coincidence that MDMA and mescaline are in the same family because the chemist who created MDMA, Alexander Shulgin, he was inspired to create something like mescaline from a mescaline trip he went on. Imagine being like, oh, I really like that psychedelic I just took. Let me tinker around and make my own version of it. And he created MDMA as a result.
Wow.
As kind of an homage to mescaline. He created MDMA and 2CB.
Huh.
Yeah.
Well, what mescaline does, it binds to the serotonin receptors in your brain. And just like LSD or magic mushrooms and stuff, it's going to cause a sense of loss of the self or ego and ayahuasca. We did one on that too, right?
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is, as Ed describes, a cross-tolerance with other psychedelics. So in other words, if you take a bunch of mescaline, it will build up a tolerance for LSD, let's say.
Right. Which is...
Yeah, I guess it hits those same receptors.
Yeah, I guess so. Which is, I guess, a problem if you take a ton of LSD. but
I have a friend from college. I won't name him. But one of the funniest quotes he has about the old days is, I've definitely forgotten I've taken acid and taken more acid.
That's a t-shirt right there,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, that's deep.
That's an 80s dead t-shirt.
It is.
Effing grooving.
Remember that?
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah. Did you have one?
No.
Okay.
No. No, mine said funkin' groovin'. So when peyote binds to those serotonin receptors, some of the cells that it binds to are responsible for something called nausea.
Oh, sure.
And one of the hallmarks of a peyote trip is you very typically feel nauseous and vomit for a couple of hours sometimes leading up to the trip. And it's really slow to cross the blood-brain barrier. So it takes hours to come on.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
But it also has a real slow burn, a long burn to it.
Right.
So compared to other trips, it's actually a very long-lasting trip, sometimes 12 hours. as opposed to, say, 6-8 hours for LSD or mushrooms or something.
Right.
12 hours is the trip you're going to be on peyote. It's also, like, really well known for being extremely visual.
Mm-hmm.
And having some interesting, like, body feelings to it, too.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, like, you can feel nauseous, you can feel euphoric, mm-hmm. you can feel euphoric and nauseous, but you're going to feel it in your body as well as have a lot of, like, really trippy visuals.
I think, didn't they take peyote in the Doors movie?
Yeah, and that's a really good...
And he vomited, I think, right?
Yeah.
Or Meg Ryan did?
That's where the whole Lizard King thing came from, because I think they took peyote in the desert. But it's also related to peyote in a different way, too, isn't it, the Doors?
Right, because Aldous Huxley wrote Doors of Perception.
Mm-hmm.
He was a big mescaline guy, wasn't he?
That book was about his first mescaline trip.
Right, and that's where the Doors got their name.
Yeah.
And then Jim Morrison went on to write a bunch of bad poetry.
Oh, man, I thought American Prayer was one of the coolest albums of all time.
I bought his poetry book. I was, you know, I was way into the Doors for, like everyone, for
right.
a brief time in college.
Sure.
And I bought the book and remember the poetry books and everything. And
did you ever listen to the album?
Yeah,
American
I thought it
Prayer?
Was all great. Now, though, it in my
yeah,
late
I haven't
40s,
listened to it in a while.
I'm kind of like, it's not great poetry.
Yeah,
although maybe it is. What do I know? I'm no poet.
You didn't even know it. So there's one other thing about Aldous Huxley too. He coined the term psychedelic.
Oh, really?
And he coined it after his first mescaline trip.
Interesting.
So mescaline. Not even just peyote, mescaline has given the world MDMA, the Doors, and the word psychedelic.
I'm going to have to tell Noel that because Movie Crush listeners will laugh at this. Noel describes about 40% of movies as psychedelic.
Oh, yeah. I'll bet he described Mandy as psychedelic, didn't he?
Oh, totally.
I mean, you could not describe it as psychedelic.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so... Let's talk about the history a bit. They've done some carbon dating. I read this one study of these peyote buttons at an archaeological dig site that said that use went as far back as 5700 BCE.
Mm-hmm.
And that those buttons still had mescaline in them.
Crazy.
That would work.
Can you imagine tripping on 7,700-year-old peyote buttons?
I mean...
Wouldn't that be something? That you shouldn't do.
Well, I wonder if that makes it weaker or if it's like a fine wine, if it's like strap in. This is 7,000-year-old mescaline.
Yeah, I know.
Can you imagine?
Like a bottle of wine from Thomas Jefferson's cellar.
Which apparently that stuff's not very good to drink.
No.
It's just like a flashy thing that
sure.
super rich people want on their shelf.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the name, though, they think is derived from, can you pronounce that?
The Nahuatl.
Nahuatl?
It's the southernmost group of the Aztecs.
Okay, but the word they used was peyotl, P-E-Y-O-T-L, peyotl.
Yeah.
Peyotl.
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 I think we got there.
And they don't know what it means, but some people think it might mean the word glistening, but not everyone is on that train.
You could easily lose the meaning of a word for glistening.
Sure.
You know, that's
not a high priority word.
No. But it's a beautiful word.
But the first mention of Westerners encountering peyote is in this 16th century study called the Florentine Codex. And there was a Franciscan missionary who wrote it named Bernardino de Sahagun. And he wrote, and this is in the late 1500s, on him who eats it or drinks it, it takes effect like mushrooms.
You know what I mean?
Also, he sees many things which frighten one or make one laugh. There you have it.
Pretty straightforward stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
But it definitely goes to show, like, yeah, people have been eating mushrooms in Europe for a very long time.
Yeah.
So over time, from like the 16th century onward in North America, people would come in contact with tribes that had like peyote rituals, and they would try peyote themselves, and they'd be like, this is crazy, or this is great, or I puked my brains out. This
right.
is awful. And so all these stories kind of started to come out. And then over time, peyote use really diminished. It used to be very widespread, not just where it grew, but
yeah.
even beyond its range. Like indigenous tribes in the area used to trade. So people who took peyote ritually, even after Colombian contact, was pretty extensive. But then once like the missionaries took hold and right. European governments took hold, that really got outlawed to where it was basically boiled down to one tribe called the Huichol.
I actually looked that one up.
Is it we or hui?
It's hoi, but the C-H-O-L is the one you emphasize. So it's Huichol.
Beautiful, Charles. That's even better than Peyotl.
At least that's what the YouTube told me. The YouTube.
Emma saying? The one with the spiral?
Yeah, is that one accurate?
I'm pretty sure they're mostly accurate.
Okay, Huichol.
Huichol.
Yeah.
Okay, so the Huichol are very well known for being the tribe most associated with peyote ritual use these days. Mm-hmm. But they're also very much opposed to Western encroachment.
Yeah.
Sometimes violently so. But I think those two are very much interconnected.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting. I didn't know that. I mean, instead of getting rid of all the things that we did and just swapping it out for Christianity like they were being told to do, they would just say, hey, man, I'll incorporate some of your Christian ideas
right
into our peyote ceremonies.
Yeah, and not just them, but the Native American church, which we'll talk about later, they did basically the same thing.
That's right.
So you've got a lot of peyote use that kind of went down to one tribe. Mm-hmm. And in a weird way, it rebounded. No, it went, it shrank.
Okay.
And then it contracted eventually even larger than before.
Oh, yeah.
To where it is today. Yeah, peyote use today is far more widespread than it was 1,000 years ago.
Wow.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Well, part of it because of, American tourists.
That's definitely part of it. And American tourists were turned on to peyote by a guy who was a UCLA anthropology student back in the 60s named Carlos Castaneda.
That guy.
Did you ever read any of Castaneda's books?
No, but he has been sort of exposed as a fraud and a con man in most academic circles. They will call him that.
Right. In academic circles.
Right.
Now, if you step over a few rings to the New Age circle,
right.
The guy is a legend.
Sure.
And he wrote these books that were supposedly ethnographic studies about Don Juan Matus. And this is where Portuguese wine comes in, Chuck.
Yeah, did you read this? Any Carlos Castaneda?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, back in the day.
Good stuff?
Yeah, it was very interesting.
I only remember it. I mean, I'd heard of him, but from the Bongwater song.
What is that?
They had a song called Folk Song where she talks about, went somewhere looking for that Carlos Castaneda experience.
Oh, Bongwater is the name of a band.
Yeah, yeah.
I gotcha.
Yeah.
That's a great name for a band.
They were great.
So Carlos Castaneda, he created these ethnographic studies that he turned into books that sold like 10 million copies. And it was him being indoctrinated into the peyote way of life by a peyote magician, a Yaqui Indian named Don Juan Matus.
Right.
And the Portuguese wine comes in because his longtime companion is convinced that Don Juan didn't exist and that Carlos Castaneda made him up and actually named him after Mateus, the Portuguese wine that she and he used to drink together all the time.
Wow.
But she's saying, like, that doesn't mean he's a fraud, that he combined all these lessons and everything that he learned from his own peyote trips to kind of create this character that was like almost a spirit character. And everybody said, no, he's a fraud. Like, this was put out there as actual anthropological field work.
Right.
And he basically lied and made all this stuff up and was exposed later on by some colleagues who really went to great trouble to expose him and undermine him.
Because he sold 10 million books.
10 million books. Still selling them, too.
It's like that guy. Remember that big controversy, like, geez, when was it? It was probably 20 years ago or maybe not that long, when Oprah exposed, or she didn't expose
him. Oh, James Fry.
Yeah, she had him on the show. A Million Little Pieces?
Yeah,
is that it?
Something like that.
I read that book. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And then found out afterward about the fact that a lot of it was made up. And I didn't care. I was like, well, fine, call it a novel then.
Right.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah, but Oprah really did not let that one go. Remember, she brought him back on for just like—
she went on TV like vouching for the guy. Or not vouching, but essentially you're sort of vouching if you recommend his book.
I guess, but really, I don't know. I think the follow-up episode was unnecessary and really put the guy in the stocks, basically.
Yeah, I just remember thinking at the time he just should not have called it a memoir, just call it a novel. But
right.
And not to diminish anyone's experience in rehab, which I think was the problem. Is it kind of very
is
much
that what
does,
offended people?
I think so. I mean, he basically made up some stuff about a real life tragedy that people go through.
Was that 20 years ago?
I don't think it was that 15, long ago.
Maybe?
When I think I was
10?
I think it was like 15, because it was right before I worked here. It's when I worked for the Chicken Killers.
We'll settle on 15 then.
So peyote, as far as Westerners go, it was really the 1800s. Its effects were first discussed by a doctor in Texas named J.R. Briggs, who apparently just kind of stumbled upon it when he met someone from the Kiowa tribe who sold him some buttons, tried it out, wrote about it in 1887.
And get this, he wrote that he it was a respiratory stimulant and his heart started racing.
Uh-huh.
And within a year, the company Park Davis from Detroit
uh-huh.
had a peyote tincture out that they said will replace the addicting cocaine for a respiratory stimulant.
And it was mescaline?
Yeah, mescaline tincture. You just drop some mescaline.
Well, it used to be the Wild West, didn't it?
Yeah, but this is Detroit.
Well, it's the Wild Midwest.
I've got one more story about this, too.
All right.
Park Davis, out of Detroit,
mm-hmm.
Aleister Crowley, I don't know how he found out that they had this mescaline tincture, but he shows up at their door
uh-huh.
in Detroit. You know, Aleister Crowley, the occultist.
Sure. He shows up and knocks on the door with his scepter.
And he goes, I hear that you have some peyote tincture. Do you mind whipping me up a special batch? And they did. And he said it was like the best peyote tincture he's ever had.
Really?
Yeah.
Out of all the peyote tinctures.
I guess he'd had a lot of them.
I believe it.
He wrote a book called like The Diary of a Mad Drug Fiend or something like that. So, I mean, he knew what he was talking about.
Yeah, I bet that's a good read.
But the chemist at a pharmaceutical company whipped up a special batch of peyote tincture for him because he showed up on the doorstep.
I wonder if he goes by the lab and he's like, guys, this is for Aleister Crowley. Just put
don't make eye contact.
Yeah, a little extra mustard in this one. So, there was a pharmacologist named Louis Lewin, and he was the first to publish an analysis of these alkaloids that we were talking about. And this was in 1894.
Mm-hmm.
So stuff was going on back then in the late 1800s that they didn't quite understand, but they were writing about it.
Sure. There's also an article from the Aspen Times in, I think, 1896 that it's just a newspaper article about some like white pioneer types who found some peyote buttons from running into an indigenous tribe and took them.
In Aspen, like, Colorado?
Yeah.
And they were where like, Hunter S. Thompson eventually would settle.
Exactly.
That's pretty funny.
It's prescient.
All right. Let's take another break here and we'll talk about the Native American church right after this.
Stuff you should know. Josh and Chuck. Woo! Stuff you should know.
All right, game off. Let's pause here to talk more about Monopoly Go. Because in Monopoly Go, you can team up with your friends for timed tournaments where you work together to build up each other's boards. It's very nice.
That's right. And the more you win together, the more awesome prizes you unlock. And there's so much to get. I'm talking about unique stickers that you can trade with friends to complete albums for big prizes, cool new playing pieces to travel the boards with, or hilarious emojis for taunting friends when you smash their buildings or heist their vaults.
Plus, Monopoly Go feels new and exciting every day with constantly changing tournaments and challenges, like digging for treasure or a robot pachinko machine. And there's always new timed events that help you win big, like massive multipliers for everything you win or rent frenzies.
That's right. There's always something fun to discover in Monopoly Go. So get off the bench and go download it now for free on Google Play or the App Store. Game on.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI and revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So Chuck, there's something really weird about peyote in modern times, and that is that the Native American church takes peyote, mm-hmm. but the Native American church is made up of plenty of tribes mm-hmm. that never were exposed to peyote traditionally. That was all a byproduct of the forced relocation and reservation settlements that the American government forced upon them.
Right. So there'll be like a Native American tribe in Canada mm-hmm. that can take this. Canada's nowhere near the natural range of peyote.
Right. And it's not like it was traded all the way up into Canada back in the day.
Right.
It literally came out of this intermingling in the Oklahoma Territory. And what makes it even more interesting to me is that you can trace it back to basically one man
yeah.
named Quanah Parker, who was a Comanche chief, who was a bad A dude.
Yeah.
He was like one of the last holdouts and then managed to go from like basically at war with white settlers in the American government to one of the leading politicians of the Oklahoma Territory who actually bridged the gap between the white government and the Indians who'd been relocated. He somehow, rather than just being, he went from bitter enemies to, okay, let's figure out how to do this the right way. But he was the one who introduced peyote to the Oklahoma Territory.
Yeah, he went to Mexico in the 1880s and I guess brought a bunch back with him. Said, this stuff's great.
He said, let me just put a little bit of this in my hat and I'm going to ride back with it.
But the Native American church became official in 1918, which I thought was interesting, like right around the same time that mescaline was synthesized. And no one really knows how many people they have because it's not like Ed says it's like not a tightly knit organization. It's more like a set of principles.
Sure.
And the first thing that came to my head is like it's probably because they're not after anything.
Sure.
It's like the Southern Baptist Convention is very everyone knows exactly how many members there are there mm-hmm. because it's very strict and formal mm-hmm. and codified.
Right.
Because there's I imagine they have an agenda of some sort.
Sure. I don't think there's anywhere near the same agenda as among the Native American church, but they do share the fact that they are a Christian organization.
Oh, yeah?
That's as far as I know, they are a Christian-based peyote church.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, the other interesting thing is you said because it's sort of a mix of all different kinds of tribes and peoples that they have just sort of settled on like it's not like if they use like drums in a ceremony or a rattle in a ceremony, it's mm-hmm. for that specific tribe. They're more like generic Native American items.
Right.
Is that about right?
Yeah. It's almost like this is, yeah. There's no better way to put it, really.
Or they'll have, you know, even if they didn't use teepees in their tribe, they will have the peyote ritual ceremony in a teepee.
Right, no matter what.
Because of its representation.
Part of its representation, but also it was just a practical measure, too, because on the reservation, under the very watchful eye of, like, the white army officers
right.
who were in charge of ridding Native Americans of their customs and ceremonies, they couldn't do these peyote rituals out in the open any longer, so they actually took them inside in secret into teepees, which is why they're conducted in teepees still today.
Gotcha.
Originally, it was just to keep from under the eyes of the people who were charged with overseeing them and eradicating their culture.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So they were like, let's just keep it in the teepee.
Right.
What happens in the teepee
stays in the teepee. You got it?
So a modern ceremony in the Native American church with peyote is usually specific, and it's focused on like healing, most likely, and it's led by something called a road man. You sit around that fire, you take your peyote, and you strap in for an all-night experience
right.
where you're supposed to like really be into it. You're not supposed to lay back and look at the stars or take a nap or anything. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to really focus on, I guess, what you're trying to accomplish.
Right, or what the peyote's telling you to pay attention to.
Sure.
Like it's not like check out my hand, I'm waving it in front of my face. Right. Everybody see that? Funkin' grooving, man.
How long has this been happening? It's like 2 hours, no, man.
Right, and there's this Scientific American writer named John Horgan who wrote about being in a Native American church peyote ritual, and he said like, man, people were sobbing, people were throwing up, like it was very solemn, he said, and they were just being taught a lot of stuff by the peyote.
Very interesting.
And the Native American churches in the United States, the only group that is allowed to trade, sell, possess,
grow,
ingest peyote. And actually, I don't think all of them can grow. I think you have to be a licensed peyotero.
You do.
To grow or harvest peyote.
Yeah.
But you can be like, I'm a member of the Native American church, and I can take this. And for a while, from I think 1978 till the 90s, you had to be a Native American to be considered a member of the Native American church by the U.S. government and be subject to be allowed to eat peyote. But that's not the case anymore.
No.
There was a Supreme Court trial, I think.
That's right. The American Indian Religious Freedom Acts in 78 and 94 basically said it can't be race specific, so it's unconstitutional. So you could technically join the Native American church. Mm-hmm. You could technically submit and petition the government and register with the government and be a peyotero and grow peyote and take it and eat it.
Yes, you, Chris Ball. That's who Chuck's speaking to right now.
Who's Chris Ball?
The guy who's listening right
now. Okay, gotcha. I hope there is one Chris Ball.
I kind of hope there's not now for legal reasons.
But this was all necessary because here in the United States, of course, it was classified as a habit-forming drug in 1929.
Which it's not.
And let me see. In 1970, the U.S. passed the Comprehensive Drug Abuse Prevention and Control Act, where they had to put everything in categories. Scheduled it as a Schedule I substance, which is, of course, the worst of the worst, they say.
Which it's not.
And that's kind of it. You got anything else?
Yeah. One thing I forgot to say is even though it's not related to LSD or mushrooms, it's frequently compared to it in potency. And I saw that it's 30 times less potent than psilocybin.
That peyote is?
Yeah.
30 times less potent?
This just seemed really weird to me, but I saw it in like an actual study from San Diego State and Tijuana Tech Party School. And it's like 1,000 to 3,000 times less potent than LSD.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, then what is this 12-hour like?
Well, that doesn't mean that it's not going to like get on top of you and you can have a really bad trip and it's going to like— You're going to trip for 12 hours, but supposedly dose specific.
Oh, okay.
Like a gram of—
Gotcha.
Maybe mescaline compared to a gram of LSD is just completely bonkers, the difference between the two.
Well, because LSD, they've synthesized down to, you know, it's a little tiny piece of paper.
Sure.
It's not eight buttons.
That's right. I think that's it then. That's peyote.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, if you want to know more about peyote, go read some Carlos Castaneda books. And since I said that, it's time for listener mail.
This is on Eyewitness Testimony. Hey, guys. I thought I'd chip in a little bit about my own personal experience. So I've been living and working in Japan for the last 15 years. I've noticed I'm perfectly capable of identifying Japanese. As a matter of fact, I can sometimes recognize and pick out students that I taught many years ago on the train or the mall with relative ease. I live and work in the Kansai area, which is a little smaller than New York City in terms of population, so I see a lot of people. Meanwhile, back in the States, during the holidays one time, I was shopping with my family, spotted my mom from across the store, and walked over to her. When I got closer, it wasn't my mom.
What?
It was another woman that looked about the same age and height. And he wrote back after I told him I was going to read it and said, you know, just wanted to point out I'm just a white dude. Just a white dude.
Right.
And he said, so I think it's not that we are somehow magically better at identifying our own race, but are just better at identifying the kind of people that we are usually surrounded by.
Oh, that's a good
which
point.
Which is usually our own race.
Good point.
Very good point.
What's this guy's name? Chris Ball?
No. He said, I thought you might find that interesting. Anyway, if you're ever in Japan again, Josh, let me know.
Sure,
Chris. And just one small question for you. Did you ever take the Japanese language proficiency test, which I think they call the Janglish test for short.
Did I ever take it? No.
Yes.
Had I would have failed spectacularly. It's one of the great shames of my life that after all these years and being married to a woman of Japanese ancestry, I speak very little Japanese.
All right. Well, he says, I've just gotten done writing a book for the first level. I'd love to send it to you.
Oh, yeah, please. Chris.
And that is from Clayton McKnight.
Clayton.
And he said, P.S., one of the textbooks I use in class has a hippie character in it named Rob.
No.
That's what he said.
Wow. Yeah, I would love to have that book because I would like to learn Japanese.
Yeah, Clayton.
Thanks, Clayton. I've been to Kansai, too, before. They have a beautiful airport there that was designed by Renzo Piano.
Nice.
It's worth even just looking up pictures of it. It's that nice.
Did you ever stay in that TWA hotel in New York?
No.
No.
Have you?
No, but I saw it in a magazine article, and I thought it looked pretty cool.
Yeah, it does look cool. I haven't been to New York for a while.
Yeah, the problem is staying out of the airport.
Yeah, JFK. I mean, I guess if you're just like staying there overnight for a connecting flight, that'd work.
Yeah, why not?
Let's do it.
All right.
If you want to get in touch with us like Clayton did and offer us a language book or anything, or just to say hi, you can go on to stuffyoushouldknow.com and check out our social links there. And you can send us an email to stuffpodcast@iheartradio.com.
Stuff You Should Know is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Hey, if you haven't heard of Visible, well, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon as low as $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Use promo code STUFF20 to receive $20 off your first month for listening to this podcast. Switch now at visible.com. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com. The Visible monthly rate is $25 per month.
In Puerto Rico, there's adventure around every corner and natural treasures waiting to be explored, like El Yunque, the only tropical rainforest in the U.S. Get swept away by natural beauty and come away with unique stories that could only be experienced in Puerto Rico and that remind you why you travel in the first place. Visits end, but stories last forever. You don't become a part of the island, it becomes a part of you. No passports required for U.S. citizens and permanent residents. Learn more and plan your trip at discoverpuertorico.com.